Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome to another episode of the Strong Source podcast. And today we have somebody in the podcast, Corina, who I admire already for many years. And we worked together also for quite some years from the Vesper point of view. And now in the podcast, and I'm really excited about that. You are head of commodity research and price risk management at Nestlé, having now, I think, a very tough job with coffee, with cocoa, with all the different commodities, sugar and dairy. You've seen them all, and you see all the risk and also the exposure that a massive FMCG like a Nestlé can have. So I think fantastic for listeners to have you here in the podcast. And I look very much forward to this chat to you. So welcome to the Strong Source podcast, Corina.
Well, thanks a lot, Alex and Martin, for inviting me to make this podcast. I really feel the privilege and the honor. I have been listening to your previous podcast where you interview the guru, the expert, the rock stars of the commodity world. So to be honest, I feel a bit of pressure today, but I'm quite confident I can share today to the commodity audience a different perspective, having a long experience in the commodity world, in particular in the largest food manufacturing company in the world, with a wide scope of the range from agricultural commodity, energy, and metals. So happy to be here. Thanks again for the invite.
Yeah, that's great, Corina. Welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, why don't you start with an introduction of ourselves, of yourselves to the audience, and we'll take it from there.
Yes, sure. I can start with a quick introduction and share maybe how I ended up in the commodity world and how I started my career in this field into life. I grew up in Rome, definitely not a commodity origin, with the small exception maybe of mozzarella, but we cannot definitely consider mozzarella as a commodity. And unfortunately, it's not traded, right? I graduated in economics at the University of Roma, La Sapienza. So my studies were focused on particular on international economics. I think since the first years of studying economics, I was fascinating about international economy, monetary policy, and definitely I was not interested in accounting. So I continued my studies. I specialized in European economics, taking a master's degree from the College of Europe in Bruges, a beautiful city in Belgium. And in fact, this college prepared students to get then to the European institution. But I took a different path and I started my career as a macroeconomist in the second largest bank in Italy, Intesa San Paolo in Turin. So this was an amazing experience where I could put in practice my studies in economics, in macroeconomics. But honestly, I was not ready to settle down in Italy yet. I wanted to especially work in an international environment. So I started spreading my CV around, and then I was invited to a vacancy, which was a sugar analyst in Nestlé in Vevey. Back then, I didn't have a clue what was the commodity world, what being a commodity analyst would mean, and also didn't know where Vevey was. But then, you know, sometimes in life we are fooled by randomness. So I went to this interview in Vevey, which is a beautiful city in Switzerland, surrounding by the Swiss mountains and the Geneva Lake. So I immediately fell in love with the place. But also I found the position very interesting, because in the end, even if I didn't know much about commodity analysis, in the end, if you have a mindset of an economist, so you can understand the dynamic of supply and demand that impact this respective market, I think you can apply these tools to any market. So then I say, why not apply to the commodity world, the sugar market? So this is how I started my career 17 years ago in Nestlé as a sugar analyst. And since then, I've been working in the commodity environment.
Yeah, that's interesting. You already mentioned a couple of things. One made me smile. Look, I needed to do some research on the dairy trade, amongst that also cheese. And I didn't know that actually mozzarella, that it is a commodity. But now you say mozzarella is not a commodity. And I'm thinking about an Italian who says that. You can probably recognize blindly 100 types of mozzarella as an Italian, right? So I thought that was very funny. And the interesting thing is we also used to say that about cocoa. Huh? There's so many different types of cocoa and probably coffee as well. So that's one of the first things that's interesting, that when we talk about commodities, many commodities, like you on an exchange when everything is standard, right? You learn it by doing. But when I went through your profile, I thought, hey, that's interesting. 2008, great financial crisis. You worked at the bank and it was a big commodity super cycle. Was it maybe those things combined that drove you to thinking about moving into commodities and Nestle, or was it really a coincidence that it was that period? And the reason I ask it also is, you know, I'm approached by people who have a genuine interest in commodities and want to break into that industry. But I think there's also plenty of people who do not know anything about that industry, which is one of the reasons why we started this podcast. And we want to promote the industry. But in your case, so what was it? Was it kind of maybe already some kind of intrinsic interest in commodities, or was it simply, well,
yeah, it's coincidence? A beautiful town and beautiful place, so why not?
Yeah, exactly. And it's been before. It was more by randomly that I started my journey into the commodity world. Yes, in fact, yeah, Martin, you're right. I was working in the banking sector probably the worst moment in time during the global financial crisis. But luckily, I didn't end up like the Lehman Brothers employee that had to leave their office within a few hours with their boxes. Now, for this was, again, I've been always interested in market analysis, supply and demand dynamics, focusing on macroeconomics and microeconomics. So my interest was first working in an international environment and secondly to apply these analysis in the end to any market. So when I got this chance to start as a sugar analyst, which was in the end of being sugar economist, I say, why not? Also because we know that working in the commodity market, you need to be the expert of the commodity, but as well, you need to always follow the macroeconomic trends. Right. I think we went through a period where macroeconomic is probably the number one driver of the commodity market. So I think I would encourage anyone, junior economist also to consider to eventually work in the commodity environment, because it's a super interesting domain to start the career and to pursue.
If you look at fast moving consumer companies, and there are plenty, you know, well known like Nestle, and there are others, but they are mostly known for their brands and for their marketeers. And what they're not that known for is for, okay, if you want to be in commodities, and I don't want to use the word trading yet, but you can also call it, you know, procurement or commercial. You would rather think about the ABCDs, so ADM, Bunge, Cargill, Dreyfus, and some of the major energy companies also based in Switzerland. But you wouldn't necessarily think about the FMCG companies. Why did you do that? And why did you stay so long on that side of the business and have not moved, for example, to one of the ABCDs of the other major energy trading houses? So what interests you from being in Nestle?
A good point. Yeah, definitely for a food manufacturing company like Nestle, the core business is not trading commodities. But still, if we consider, especially the Nestle perspective, how relevant are commodities for the company, then you understand why there is in the end a lot of focus on key commodities, in particular for Nestle case in cocoa and coffee market. I think if I can share a few numbers, I think about 40% of the cost of goods sold in Nestle is made of raw material. And of course, if you run a business like in confectionery or in beverage, which is our coffee business, you really need to anticipate what is going to be the cost of your cocoa or of your coffee. imagine running a business, deciding where you allocate your budget with a cocoa and coffee price, which has increased about 100% or 70% just over the last 12 months. So my point is that it still is very critical to manage the commodity exposure in a food manufacturing company. In fact, we give a lot of focus and resources to manage properly these exposure. In particular, we invested over the last years in having a good research team. So in order to try to better anticipate the commodity market, to have a good intelligence, and as well as to protect the business from the huge volatility of the commodity through financial hedging, derivatives. And also, I think maybe another point is that, okay, coming back to cocoa and coffee, we buy about 10% respectively of the world cocoa and coffee demand. So we are definitely a key player. And I think when I experienced working cocoa and coffee for Nestle, you still at the center of the stage. It's not not any relevant in the company.
But that's the thing when you are the size that you are as a Nestle, where you say, you know, 10% world market, that for some of these commodities, that's massive, right? That has a massive. That's also when I was trading and Nestle called, it was like all alarm bells was like, okay, there we go, right? And if they jump into a market, it has such an impact on with volumes on the market. And, you know, you don't come in as Nestle to say, well, let's do one or two loads, right? You immediately need a big volume. What needs to be available in the market as well? How can you manage that when you go into markets, people with a size of a company like yourself and still manage the risk? Because, you know, sometimes maybe the price is not always the biggest issue, but availability, especially for your size. Now, if you need a few loads here and there, you know, every company, there's always somewhere to get, even if, you know, maybe you pay a higher price. But if you come in size like you are, you know, how do you make sure that there is availability? I mean, you saw, for example, an example is, for example, Ferrero. When Ferrero once started, you know, they didn't have their own hazelnut plantations. But then they saw how much impact it has for them, how it could be cornered, and they started to grow their own to make sure they have supply. How do you do that within a Nestle?
My procurement colleague, because of course my main talk was I manage the price risk of the commodities, but of course I'm closely in collaborating with my colleagues who manage the physical sourcing of the commodities. I think definitely, as you said, the large volume of Nestle needs might be a challenge, but I think it's also an opportunity, leveraging our scale, to build a strong relationship with our suppliers that at certain times give us an advantage, maybe versus other small player. I think even during the difficult period of the 2022 during the COVID and the various crises in the commodity world, Nestle has always been able to provide the raw material required to the various plants. Again, and leveraging our scales, our resources, also our presence around the world. Of course, my colleagues have a various strategy to try to make sure that supply is ensured. And among these, of course, is a flexibility in the origins of the various categories.
Thanks.
Could you share with us some of your analytical processes? So you are, it's a very interesting role that you have. So head of research and head of price risk management. Those two are critical in commodity trading companies, but also in FMCGs. But for a lot of people, this is like a black box. And so how does it actually work to make an analysis of supply and demand, but also translate that into where prices need to go? And what prices? Well, prices of futures, flat price, the curve, differentials, products made from the beans. So could you share with us how that process works? So meaning you look at the screen, you see a number, you see the price of coffee, you see the price of cocoa, that's fine. But how do you and your team actually go through the process of analyzing those markets and then determining, okay, this is the price on the screen and this is where we think fair value is. And this is then how we position Nestle. And then in this case, it's not positioning Nestle to make money trading in and out of those positions, but basically to manage its price cover so that it can sell its products competitively into the retail sector. I mean, that is at the end of the day what you do, right? If I'm correct, but please correct me if I'm wrong. So I'm super interested in the analytical process, how you do that, if you can share that with us.
Yeah, sure. So I have a team of five analysts, economists, and four traders. So starting with the role of the research and analytical part, I think what we focus, I guess, on three main aspects. First of all, data gathering and collection. Mm-hmm. Then data analysis and then communication. Starting from the first one, data gathering collection, of course, we give a lot of importance of getting the right information at the time in a timely manner. So we leverage both internal proprietary data as well as we pay external consultants that give us their insight on the market. Mm-hmm. For instance, for in coffee, we have our agronomists on the field that they can give us a view of the expected outcome of the various crop around the world, but also we leverage external consultants. As I said before, also we leverage our strong relationship with suppliers because, of course, they also have great market intelligence. So having, again, collecting the data is critical. Then we digest and we analyze this data through various models, various analytical indicators, starting from the more probably traditional ones like seasonality, mean reversion, fair value model, mm-hmm. or the analysis of the CFTC, technical indicators. Mm-hmm. And more recently, in fact, we also started a journey to implement machine learning predictive mm-hmm. analytics in our models, leveraging our internal data scientist team as well as external companies. Mm-hmm. So, because again, commodity markets, as mentioned before, are extremely volatile. So we all know that we cannot get the market right 100% mm-hmm. in the next week or even imagine the next 3 months or 6 months. But we strongly believe in Nestle that through a rigorous analysis, we at least can reduce the odds of missing the market, right? Mm-hmm. So buying at the right moment. So then through this process of analysis and this indicator, then I think it's the ability of the specific analyst to give a different weight to this different analytical analysis in a specific moment. You know, sometimes it's the macro, which is the key driver of the markets. Other times it's the respective S&D. And so we come out with then a price outlook, let's say, or more a price direction. But also related to that, we build a price scenario. Yeah. Again, trying to leverage a rigorous approach. Yeah. So we use a probabilistic model based on Monte Carlo simulation to understand which is the real risk at stake. So on the base of that, we then communicate all this information within our procurement community, in particular to the traders, to the owner of the cocoa and coffee procurement category, which are the final decision maker of our hedging strategy. And we then build our hedging recommendation. So my team has the responsibility to be vocal on our hedging recommendation, with leveraging then various financial hedging tools that go from futures to options. And also we decide to remain relative short or be relative long in our position.
Yeah.
So this is in a nutshell how we work with analytics.
Well, that sounds very sophisticated. that's good. Yeah.
For which commodities, Corina, do you have the traders? So you have, you say, four traders, I believe you said, or five. Which commodities do you have traders for? And because I think there are a lot of raw materials that you buy that are very small, but you maybe don't have a trader for.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we have one dedicated trader for cocoa, one dedicated trader for coffee, and then the other two traders may manage a wide range of commodity, which are relatively smaller in spend, but still critical for different business in Nestle. So we manage financially hedge sugar, grains, in particularly corn, soybean meal, in the various wheat markets. We do financial hedging in dairy, as well as in energy and metals, in particular aluminum. I know Nestle is known, of course, for being a large cocoa and coffee company, but as I mentioned before, there are other commodities, which are key for different businesses. So Nestle, for instance, pet food business is critical for Nestle and has a very large exposure in grains. So then also grains materials are very important. But as well for the nutrition, Nestle nutrition business, dairy is also a key category. And then, of course, aluminum for all our packaging. So definitely we need to give the dedicated resource analytics and effort to all these categories.
Yeah. Now, the coffee and the cocoa markets, they go through unprecedented disruption. And I think it is interesting for a lot of players, because what the markets are going to do in a brutal way is trying to stimulate supply and cut demand, in essence. And that is what these markets need to do. Now, if you look at cocoa, you hear things, and I've experienced that in the past a couple of times, but not to the extent that we see it now, is how can you cut demand? You can cut demand by increasing price. This has been a very slow process so far. You can do it through reformulations and using more fillers and more sugar and that kind of stuff. You can do it by promoting other categories. You can do it by shrinkflation. Chocolate is not a staple food, but people really like it. Now, I want to move to coffee. And the funny thing is, I don't know whether you follow Javier Blas, but he's a well-known Bloomberg commodity reporter, and he is the writer of The World for Sale. A fantastic guy and very knowledgeable.
Great book.
And he writes about coffee a lot. And I said to him on LinkedIn, I said, look, manage your expectations. You need to start drinking tea. And he said, Martijn, look, I'd rather drink olive oil than tea. The point is, how do you reformulate coffee? So the things that I mentioned, which are intended to reduce demand for chocolate, what are the levers in the coffee market outside of increasing the price? What can you do? Because coffee is coffee, right? So in addition to increasing the price, to cut demand, and to force people, even like Javier and maybe yourself as an Italian, to drink tea, huh? What can you do to cut demand, to ration demand? Because that's what is needed to balance that S&D on the longer term. But also 50% of global coffee supply, correct me if I'm wrong, comes from Brazil and Vietnam. It's basically the same now for cocoa, where it comes 50% from Ghana and Ivory Coast. You're to a large extent, you depend on those two origins. But the reason why chocolate demand hasn't declined a lot yet is because everyone was hedged to an extent. And no one wanted to lose market share. So, and everyone thought it would be a one-off situation, but it isn't. And now slowly but surely you see demand declining, but it has to. So I'm just wondering, because look, the coffee market reached all-time highs. Now it dropped, I think, 5% this week, but still it's close to all-time highs. I'm still wondering, what is this market going to do, or what does it need to do in order to cut demand? And that is the huge challenge for FMCG companies, that is not only managing price risk, but at the end of the day, everyone knows that something has to happen on the demand side as well, right? Or you don't agree?
Yeah. Well, again, I can share my thought about where eventually this market might go. But I think it's important also to understand that the origin, the root cause of the current cocoa and coffee rally, because I think they are quite different origin. I think for coffee, it has been really weather-driven phenomenon. I think we experienced since 2021 a series of unfavorable weather events that hit continuously the supply of the coffee market, starting from the frost in July 2021 in Brazil, hitting the Arabica output, and then the flood in Colombia in 2022, and then drought in Brazil, and so on and so forth. So I believe for the coffee market and how usually work in the commodity market, that the high price cure high price. So we'll eventually get, barring any weather anomalies, some correction in supply. I think Brazil in particular has a large potential of still growth of coffee in the coming years. I think for cocoa, it's quite different because this is more beyond weather, which did impact the cocoa market. We also face some structural issue, especially in the supply chain of cocoa, which then limit the usual response of supply to high prices. And we see in West Africa, in particular in Ghana, old trees, low farm cares, and then also the spread of the disease, which is quite difficult to cure. So probably then the rebalancing on the cocoa market will take longer than the coffee market.
Okay.
Is what we see.
Very clear. Okay.
It's an interesting way you say demand has to cut, right? Because you don't want to cut demand, basically, right? You want to increase the supply. I mean, why are we limited to very few regions that can produce these crops? I mean, that's what you want to avoid, right? That's also what you see, for example, now with happening when you had palm oil. Palm oil is always Indonesia, Malaysia, and now you see it also being grown in Colombia and other regions because. You know, you don't want to be depending on just a few regions. Can you about cocoa? Can you actually do crops like cocoa also in other regions than Ghana and Ivory? Or is the weather circumstances so special there? Should we just open a new crop somewhere?
Well, we see some growth in Latin America, definitely. Yeah. So this is the other origin where we can see eventually the future growth of cocoa.
Corina. We have a lot of young people in the audience, and they're always interested in, you know, what are people looking for in young talent. So people like you, who have a long career, and I said I think really nice combination of analytics, research, and price risk management. What are the things you're looking for in graduates or people with 1 or 2 years of experience who are interested in a company like Nestle, and who are interested in the commodity space.
But I think it's also nice, Corina, to add on that one, Martijn, is to say, because your team, right, support and helps and collaborates with also the traders again. So it's a bit of different. What makes so cool about your team, right, versus the traders? It's not like a battle, but, you know, I think it's amazing for young people to know there are different roles within the commodity space, right? So,
yeah.
I've been recruiting because also I've been managing the commodities research team in the last 6 years, and over the last 4 years I've been managing also the trading desk. So over these years, of course, I have made changes to my team. I've recruited, and the profile, of course, for the economists from the commodities research role are different versus what I look as for the role as of a trader. But I think probably the common factor that I usually look when I interview young candidates is to have demonstrate analytical mindset. As I mentioned before, also when I started my career, I think having this analytical mindset help you to be flexible and apply your analytical skill to various circumstances. And I think this type of flexibility is very important in the commodity world. I also look for someone that is able to work in a team. For me is and myself, I really value a people person because we need to leverage each other's energies, synergies and energies, collaborating within the team. So the traders need to work hand in hand with the analysts to exchange their information, but also to build this network internally and externally. So I think the being a people person is also important. And another aspect, in fact, which I look for, both, in fact, for the traders position and the research role, is be a good communicator. Because in the end, you can do the most fancy analytical analysis in the world, but then you need to be able to explain the result to a different level of audience within the company. You know, the commodity world has a really specific jargon that not everyone understand. I often tell my team, remember that our stakeholders don't know, some of them, what bullish or bearish means. So don't use this technical word.
Yeah.
So we have to challenge then or tailoring our communication to the different audience and keep them always up to date on what is happening and educate them to the world of commodities. So again, communication is also another skill that I look for when I interview the candidates for my team.
Yeah, that's important. It's interesting that you say that, the slang that we use is not always known in the higher echelons. You know, the structure of the futures market, whether it is in a carry or in an inverse, is one of the most important things you look at as a commodity risk manager or trader. But this is not so easy to explain into the higher echelons, right? And even in the media, and where they prefer to talk about the flat price, whether this goes up or down, right? Now, interesting.
But hey, do you see that? Yeah. Then just one quick question is that, do you see then people from the commodities teams within Nestlé also moving into roles within Nestlé into the management that are outside of just commodities, right? So that they are responsible for marketing or the commercial side, the sales side, or things like that, more towards the final product of the business? Or do they all stay within the commodities because it's just too good and too amazing?
It really depends on the respective career aspiration of the various team members. I see certain people that are passionate not only about the commodity work, but about their respective commodity. So we have some coffee passionate or cocoa passionate that they would not consider to move into another category. So not definitely beyond the commodity space. But whereas other profiles are more flexible, they have the curiosity to experience a different role. And I think the beauty of the work for Nestlé is that you have eventually the possibility to move into completely different role in a different department. For instance, the traders on my team, of course, they have a very similar profile the traders that work in the treasury team in Nestlé that manage currency exposure. In fact, we have a quite good flow of talents from the treasury department. And of course, a trader is is very strong in finance. So he has, if he wants, all the opportunity to move into the various finance position within Nestlé.
Yeah. One thing that comes back a lot in the podcast is resilience and adaptability. And if we look at the last couple of years, we had the Russia-Ukraine war and we had COVID. And those were, for people involved in the commodities industry, real focus on, I think, energy and grains were, yeah, incredible situations. I think for most of us, COVID was unprecedented. We had never experienced something like that before. Wars we have experienced before, but could you share with us a bit how you and your teams dealt with something like COVID, mm-hmm. and what you did in order to, and also what the audience likes, and you know, Alex and me as well, how you dealt with that situation personally, right?
Sure. I first would like to remind how crazy was that period from 2020 to 2022. Because, of course, now we see the cocoa crisis, the coffee crisis. And in the history, commodities has always been facing period of volatility. But I think the 2020-22 was unique because we saw most of the commodities moving in tandem, all reaching extremely high volatility and extremely high level. I think we had the various commodity registering level never seen before, from palm oil to aluminum to natural gas, wheat, and so on and so forth. So it was, for me, a very unique period, also because it was not only about the huge event, which was the COVID outbreak in 2020 and then the war in Ukraine in 2022. But it was a series of black swan events that nobody could forecast. It just was to remind a minor but important shock that we faced. I remember I think it was March 2021, when a container ship was stuck in the Suez Canal for 5 days, so blocking the trade of about 5% of the global transit for a container. Or I remember also a few months after the start of the war in Ukraine that suddenly Indonesia banned the export of palm oil for 1 month. So these are all shock that that added to the virus crisis. And also not to forget the various events, weather events that we face. With Brazil, the worst drought in 100 years, the European dryness in 2022, which also contributed to the energy crisis. Again, was really a unique period. So how my team has managed this this part? Well, first of all, I always like telling my team, especially I remember those periods, that we've never been so popular in the company like that period, because everyone in the company were reaching us and they said, okay, what is happening? What is going to happen?
Yeah.
So the the role of the commodity research team and the training desk got very popular. Then, of course, as I said, in the way how we operate, we strongly believe on a data-driven approach. So we try to maximize the understanding of what was happening, trying to anticipate the potential scenarios. But then, so this is on the analytical part. But on the trading side, how we manage that, we maximize during that period the use, for instance, of options, which is a perfect tool that give us the insurance to protect against catastrophic events that were in the end occurring in that moment in time. So again, I always think through crisis, you stretch yourself eventually to fill some gap that it would have been maybe more difficult to fill in a different circumstances. But this crisis helped us eventually to improve in the way we operate and to better manage these crisis events.
Yeah, I think that's a super interesting comment. You know, I think most people know the comment, never waste a good crisis. But the point is, when you have disruptions, and the energy crisis was one, that I believe it was the first time that companies that weren't really perceived as commodity companies all of a sudden were very conscious of their energy exposure and that they didn't have a hedging framework for energy. And you and these disruptions, and probably also now with cocoa and coffee, it increases your consciousness and you are much more aware of what you're exposed to and whether you have the right processes, systems, and people in place to manage that. So at the end of the day, you know, it can be exhausting, but you learn a lot from it as well. So that's a great thing. The other thing that you said is, you said it a couple of times now, you need to think in scenarios. I think what a lot of people do, they try to be perfect on where the price is going. But much more important is making some scenarios and then being able to decide with your team what you're going to do in each of the scenarios. It's very, very unlikely that one of the scenarios that you anticipate is going to be exactly like that. But if you have thought about certain scenarios and when you have certain ranges that you think are possible, then you are already prepared instead of waiting for it to happen and then staring at your screen and not having thought about it. And that's why I always said in cocoa, you need to think the unthinkable. Yeah, people are going to be irrational.
But I think as well, scenarios, but also communicate these possible scenarios internally, right? Because especially, you know, if you are in a pure trading company, people understand everything, etc. But exactly what you said already, Carina, you have in big food companies, you have people that are fully dedicated on commodities, people that are doing other things within the company that have nothing to do with commodities directly. So if you communicate these scenarios also internally, what can happen, etc., you anticipate, you manage these expectations as well from their side. And I think that's also very important.
Yeah, no, it's fully true, because so how it works within Nestle, so the procurement side is responsible for setting, for instance, the buying decision, the hedging decision. But then we need to closely communicate to the business, because in the end, they are the P&L owner of the confectionery or the coffee or the pet food business. So they are the one hit by this decision. So this is why it's extremely important that we maximize the communication with the business and also in explaining to them, okay, this is our strategy, but these are also the risks we might face. And because of one input into our decision is definitely which is the risk appetite of the respective business in that moment in time. And this really depends on their marketing and sales strategy. I think some of them are at a certain moment in time, they are maybe more risk adverse versus in other moment. And on the basis of this input, we then adjust our hedging strategy decision. And yeah, regarding the quantification of the risk, because of, you know, economists are good always to say yes. On the one hand, the market can go high, and the other hand, the market can go lower, and explain why. But yeah, but here, Nestle people need to understand. But the so what? What does it mean in terms of financial risk?
Absolutely.
And so, as I said before, we have further developed again these probabilistic tools where we can integrate our input and then can give us a better and more quantifiable way to understand which is really the money at risk, also consider the different level of confidence that we want to have into these scenarios. This is a tool that really is helpful to give this type of visibility.
Do you also do already something with AI on that? I mean, it's so broad AI, of course, but in that sense of...
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, we have been leveraging AI more for predictive analytics, for price forecasting, and we have in the project to combine what is a Monte Carlo simulation, which is a more a statistic tool into the various AI models. And so now we are, in fact, we have an internal department of data scientists that help us to use the various machine learning model to be applied into, for instance, these simulation scenarios.
Will be interesting what will come out of that.
Throughout my career, I met some people that I really admired, but also some people that I haven't met that I admired. And I mentioned you three. The last podcast that we made was with Dwight Anderson, the CEO of Osprey. That was always someone I really admired. And also a guy called Paul Tudor Jones, one of the most famous investors, commodity traders in the world, who I also met. And someone who I always admired, and was Charlie Munger. And those three, some are known for interesting quotes, but all of them, they are known for long, consistent success in financial markets. Now, are there any people that you admire, that you say, well, I like to read from them, or I live by some of their quotes, or maybe in Nestle, certain leaders, managers that you have worked with, which were inspiring to you, and you feel like, yeah, I'm glad that I work with those, and they have learned me things that, you know, still kind of guide me through my career, or maybe day-to-day job.
Yes, yeah, I would like to refer to some of my previous managers because I believe they are experts in commodities, and they really were a great mentor and guide for me to get into a better understanding of the commodity world. And so my first manager, in fact, Steve Dunn, that brought me into Nestle, is a cocoa expert, as well as a coffee expert. He shared really his passion about this commodity market. And the other person I would like to mention is Paul Hughes, is, on the other hand, a guru, the expert of the grain market. Paul Hughes is shared to me especially what all the, I think, the process of being a good analytical analyst. In particular, I remember when we became head of commodity research, he made all the team reading a great book, which I would really recommend to our audience, which is Super Forecasting from Professor Ted Locke. The book is about... the concept that has developed this professor of behavioral economics, that everyone can be a good forecaster without being an expert on a specific domain. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, you need to develop a specific skill and follow a specific process. And in this way, you can become a good forecaster. So if you apply these skills into our commodity world, this is a great way to grow a team of good commodity forecasters. And I really like this book, and I really recommend it, and I share a few tips that that are so true and so valid that I would like to mention a few of them. For instance, one of the principles that Professor Tang recommend of a good super forecaster is that a good analyst is the one whose beliefs are hypotheses to be tested and not treasury to be guarded. And yeah, we see that a lot in the commodity world, right? Mm-hmm. When I see someone, a big ego guy, they say, a woman, that say, I know everything about commodity. The market is going to get to this direction. And never test their his hypothesis. I think this is a big error in mm-hmm. being a good analyst.
Yeah.
And I think another element that is come out from this book is that if you want to be a good forecaster or analyst, you need always to adjust your view in light of a new information. So this yeah. is also about being yeah. flexible. And the commodity world where the fundamentals can really change dramatically from a weather event or any other political shock, you need to have this type of flexibility. So, yeah, no, I really would recommend this book to everyone that want to work in the commodity domain because it's helped to build a good mindset and process to be a good forecaster. So, yeah, so this is how Paul Hughes, my previous manager, set up his research team following this principle. And I really appreciate that he transferred this to me as well.
Nice. And that's super forecasting from Philip Tetlock.
Yes, Professor Tedlow, yes.
I never heard about the book, but it's a good one for the list.
Good for the Facebook data science people as well.
But I'm going to implement already the first recommendation is to kind of flag what you said. In terms of what I at some stage heard in an interview with Lloyd Blankfein, the former CEO of Goldman. And he was asked by the interviewer, so well, how is it that you guys are so well in forecasting? And Blankfein said, no, we are not forecasting anything. We are good at anticipating. So I think this is also brings it back to doing the scenario analysis. The scenario analysis is maybe not so much forecasting, but what it is thinking about possible scenarios and be prepared for that and having the optionality. And that's also what you mentioned a couple of times, having the optionality to move still given the scenario that is unfolding. I think that makes people successful in the commodities industry when you have an open mind, when you can make certain scenarios and be prepared for where they happen. And other people with a more closed mind, they cannot.
On top of that, Martijn, I think what is very important as well is what we discussed in a few podcasts in the beginning was as well about are you going to stick to a position that is unsure, is not maybe not good because you just don't want to give up, you have egoism, or it's just hard to let it go for whatever reason you have. But you know, when you have exactly what you said, the flexibility and all that, but on top of that, I think it's very important to say, okay, cut your losses on time, right? Just move on next day and go and build up a new position
but also hear what Corina said, you need to adapt to changing variables. Now, this looks like an open door, but the reality is that often people take decisions based on gut feel or sentiment or emotions. When you have a process where you have listed all the variables in your analytics, which drove you to a certain game plan, you can constantly review all those elements. And you can say, well, these one or two, they don't longer apply. Or the weighing, as you said, Corina, the weighing changed. The macro maybe become way less important than the speculative position, something like that, or the technicals, right? And then you can adjust those. And then you have a numbers-based, informed decision process. And that is why I said to you in the beginning, this looks very sophisticated. And it's good to see, because I see, or I have seen very often, people who were not at all sophisticated, and it was just gut feel. And being successfully on gut feel, there are not that many who can do that. And maybe guys like Munger and Paul Tudor Jones and maybe Dwight, but not that many. It's also difficult to pass it on to the next generation, right? And what Corina can do is you can teach people who join the team on the process, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. In fact, this book is really against the gut feel and really to guide to a discipline process and to reduce as much as possible the human bias. I really recommend. In fact, I can mention another tips that comes from the book that I really apply in the way how we carry research in Nestle is a big believer of the wisdom of the crowd.
Yeah.
Which is much better to consider various individual independent forecasts or analysis of a specific question or a specific material instead of just relying on the view of the one expert, because the individual might have eventually different information that another individual might not have. So if you can make the average of the varying individual forecast, you most probably will end up with a better forecast than just relying on the single expert. And in fact, this is what we do, for instance, in our crop intelligence. We have, yes, our people on the field. We get the figures from what our Nestle people see. But I always ask my analysts but what other people on the field are looking at? What are the suppliers' intelligence are telling you? So that we see the various trends, the outlier, and sometimes also we question our own number. I think it would be risky to rely only on one single source of this type of information.
Yeah. But also, does every commodity raw material allow you to do an amazing analysis, right? Because of the lack of information of some of them, right? So I think there are commodities like cocoa maybe or grains that have much more information available from the market that you can buy, consultants, crop tours, versus maybe smaller ones like nuts or, more specific. Is that also how you see that from your side?
Yes, for sure. Definitely, grains has the beauty of having many information publicly available, for instance, through the USDA. But I think it's easier, I would say, crop probably to estimate, whereas especially the tropical commodities like coffee, but in particular cocoa, are extremely difficult. On our side, of course, then we invest in research and in data, also depending on our exposure. Of course, we have a large exposure on cocoa and coffee, so we have people on the field for those categories. We don't have people on the field for sugar or for corn. Also because, again, sometimes it's not required. There are already public information available, good enough to have a good view in the market. But I think, yes, we always, for agricultural commodity in particular, we always want to understand the supply and demand balance and dynamics. But I think there are certain analytical indicators modeled that can be done, for instance, just looking at the price series itself. So in this case, you can rely eventually on these alternative models, just looking at the price series and make the various algorithms to try to understand eventually the price forecast.
Yeah. Then also we're coming close to the end of the podcast already, Corina. It goes really fast. But I still have a question, because you said about your team, right? You have data people, analytical people, different characters. You have the traders. What is your style of leadership, of management? You have some great examples, of the books, but also the people you have encountered. You're already in many, many years in this business of commodities. How do you try to guide everybody through these extreme hard cycles in the market as well?
Mm-hmm. I like considering myself as an orchestra director, managing a team of expert. So I'm very far from being a micromanager. I really give my team the enough independence to carry their role, as because I consider them expert in what they do, in the specific category they cover and the specific task. Of course, my role is then to guide the team to eventually change their objective to better meet the needs of the company or the needs required in the specific moment by the company. So I need to allocate wisely the workload in trying to make sure also that each of team member can leverage his particular skill in a particular project. So some team members are great in communication. So then I push them to meet what are the needs within the company that I mentioned before to communicate about the commodity market. Other team members are super strong in modeling and analytics. So they are focusing on this specific task. Of course, I try also to elevate everyone to cover what are for me the key needs of being a good commodity analyst and trader. Yeah, so I think I'm quite open in getting feedback from my teams and the other way around, as I honestly constantly learn from my team members. So, and in the end, I really, as I say, I'm a people person. I really enjoy working with a team.
That's
it shows.
Yeah. Thanks. Martijn, do you have a last question? Otherwise, I would like to thank Corina.
Yeah, maybe a last one. And after going through a lot of cycles, market cycles, both the commodity cycle, but also financial market cycles, I developed some kind of slogan for myself, which was kind of representing my philosophy, which was the game is to survive, not to shine. Do you have something like that? Some kind of a word or a quote in your head or something which stands for you after some kind of philosophy after all those years that you have been working in Nestlé in the commodity space that you feel like, yeah, okay, that maybe not, but that is for me. And for me, the game is to survive, not to shine stands for that I always felt a huge responsibility to make sure that the business, which consisted of thousands of people who didn't necessarily know anything about the futures market, but and so people in sales, in the factories, in logistics, they weren't always aware of the risks that we saw on the trading desk. And I felt extremely responsible to make sure that they could do their job, that we together could build the franchise, but I would never take the risk of blowing the things up. Like, for example, happened with several companies in the cocoa industry. You have Euromar Transmar, for example. You had Noble, you had Armajaro, and other companies that have been taken over. And not to shine stands for what you sometimes see in the media online, people having a wrong perception about what trading is. It's not about big egos. It's not about go big or go home. It's about building a franchise. So that was for me that kind of that became where I stood for. Is there something that you have in mind when you say, well, yeah, that's my philosophy in doing my job, in running my business and my responsibility towards Nestlé and the teams?
Yeah, maybe we'd like to leave this audience with maybe probably two messages. One, and I'm quoting the current head of Nestlé Procurement in Nestlé, that always remind us, even during crisis period, that work is just work. So he remind everyone to be balanced between what we need to do at work and also to balance what is life after work. Because, of course, yeah, in the commodity world, as I said, we face extremely volatile time that can make people very stressful. But and of course, I encourage always my team to be serious on what we do, how we manage this volatility and stress. But let's always keep in mind a good balance between work and life outside work. So this is probably one of the messages. And maybe another message for the one that want to start their career in commodities. So when I say that I spent 17 years in commodity, some people might say, this must be boring, right? Spending so long in a specific... No. But in fact, in commodity, you never get bored,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
There is always something new to learn. I think I mentioned the various crises that we see. And especially, there is always something new to learn. 2 days ago, I found myself trying to understand what Trump tariff would mean on aluminum imports into US. What would be the impact in Nestle? So whereas, honestly, my focus has always been more on soft commodities. But I think really the commodity world is so dynamic that there is always something new to learn and experience. So I really encourage everyone to start the journey in commodity.
That's an amazing one to finish this podcast with. Corina, thank you so much for being in our podcast and shining here. I mean, I wish you all the best in these cycles with these tough prices and tough markets. And then also, indeed, what you just mentioned as last one is the political one, you know, that comes on top of it. What was already tough. And I think being for 70 years in the commodities, I think it cannot be long enough because it's the best industry to be in. So we hope to see you for many more years.
No, I also really want to thank you. What I really liked is that you provided insights about Nestle, how it works, and that you were very personal as well. And that is the right combination that we're looking for in the podcast. So thanks a lot for that. And I wish you well in the markets.
I need that. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Have a great day. Yeah?
Bye-bye.